The Da Vinci Code is a new book, a high-minded thriller about a big secret, so big that both the people who know it and the people who are trying to find out about it want it to be kept secret. One side with concealment, with puzzles, codes, and symbols, and the other side with violence. One of the characters in the book calls the concealment of this secret the biggest cover-up in human history. The author of The Da Vinci Code is Dan Brown. He joins us in our Washington studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you're the hot guy. I mean, your book shot to the top of the bestseller list, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, several others. It's cited this week as proof that publishing is not dead yet. why do you think this book has such a buzz going?
I would love to say it's about the writing and it's about the storytelling, and it is a fun read, but I think the real reason has more to do with the subject matter. The book incorporates Leonardo da Vinci's artwork, which everyone loves, codes, and most of all, secrets, ancient historical secrets, which interest us all.
The first 30 chapters of the book, and I'm not kidding, take place in the Louvre in the middle of the night. A famous curator has been murdered, and his naked body is found in one of the galleries, positioned on the floor like Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Describe that for us.
Well, the curator has been murdered, and in his final moments has arranged his own body in the form of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, the famous anatomically correct sketch of a naked man on his back with his arms and legs outstretched, kind of like a snow angel. And around his body are codes and symbols that make no sense to the French judicial police. And Robert Langdon, this Harvard iconographer and symbologist, is called in to decipher these symbols, which lead to Da Vinci's paintings and eventually to this secret.
This is the beginning of a sort of a very exciting thriller-style art history lecture by Mr. Langdon on the paintings of Leonardo da Vinci. And he deals with the Mona Lisa, with the Madonna of the Rocks, with the Last Supper. Why Da Vinci?
Because Da Vinci was a man centuries ahead of his time. He was a prankster. He loved codes, and he hid symbolic messages in his paintings. And to art historians out there, this will not seem like new news. But to most of us, the idea that a painting as famous as the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper, the idea that this has hidden meaning, this is intriguing. And when I was studying art history at the University of Seville, that was really the first time that I saw the Last Supper for what it truly is, which is a fresco full of codes.
Well, now, if we go into it, we'll start giving away secrets.
We don't want to do that.
But it is amazing. And you said some things about the Last Supper, which, you know, I, like everyone else, studied when I was studying art history. And I didn't know some of that stuff.
Without ruining the book, I will just say that the Last Supper has in it a disembodied hand clutching a dagger. It has a very famous historical character that nobody realizes is in the painting. And it has a very interesting architecture and arrangement of people around this table.
There are a couple of times in the book when your hero, Mr. Langdon, delivers a little riff on what he calls the sacred feminine.
Yes.
Goddess worship.
Absolutely.
Now that sounds to me like something that I would like to know more about.
Well, I'll just preface this by saying that in pre-Christian times, we lived in a world of gods and goddesses. Mars, the god of war, had Venus, and Osiris, the Egyptian god, had Isis. Today we live in a world only of gods. And it's funny that the word god in our language conjures images of piety and power, and yet its counterpart, goddess, is a fantastical word. It doesn't conjure much of anything except mystical games of some sort.
Let's hear one of these little lectures. Would you mind reading? There's one on page 125 where Mr. Langdon is talking about how the sacred feminine has been suppressed by modern religions.
Yes. Women, once celebrated as an essential half of spiritual enlightenment, had been banished from the temples of the world. There were no female Orthodox rabbis, Catholic priests, nor Islamic clerics. The once hallowed act of Hieros Gamos, the natural sexual union between man and woman, through which each became spiritually whole, had been recast as a shameful act. Holy men, who had once required sexual union with their female counterparts to commune with God, now feared their natural sexual urges as the work of the devil, collaborating with his favorite accomplice. The days of the goddess were over. The pendulum had swung. Mother Earth had become man's world, and the gods of destruction were taking their toll. The male ego had spent two millennia running unchecked by its female counterpart. The obliteration of the sacred feminine in modern life had caused what the Hopi Native Americans called koyaanisqatsi, life out of balance.
Well, does this get you into any trouble with the great religions of the world?
You know, I was a little bit nervous when the book came out because, yes, there are some very controversial ideas put forth in the book. And I'm pleased to say that I'm getting letters from priests and a lot of letters from nuns, letters from pagans, letters from feminists, and everybody is excited and positive about the ideas in this book.
I know that you must be aware that people are using your most recent book before this one, Angels and Demons, as a kind of a guidebook to Rome.
Yes, there's a cyber cafe somewhere near Bernini's famous Fountain of the Four Rivers, and it seems every other day some tourist has stopped in there and said, I'm in this cyber cafe and I have your book and I've followed all these statues and paintings and buildings, and you're right, they're all right where you said they were.
How long does it take you to research a book like this? I assume that among other things, you would hear from the world if you got anything wrong.
Certainly, and it takes me about 2.5 years to entirely research and write a book like this. Before I even started writing a page, I'd spent a year in research, and a lot of the research for Angels and Demons that I did in Vatican City played into this book, as well as my art history training in Seville.
You're trying not to get too fictional with the facts here?
Absolutely. The only thing fictional in the Da Vinci Code is the characters and the action that takes place. All of the locations, the paintings, the ancient history, the secret documents, the rituals, all of this is factual.
So is this going to encourage us all to get out there and re-examine Da Vinci?
I hope so. Da Vinci's artwork is absolutely fascinating, and when you just look at the Mona Lisa and wonder why she's smiling, you've just scratched the surface. There's a reason she's smiling. There's a reason The Last Supper is such an enigmatic and famous work, and paintings like Madonna of the Rocks, Adoration of the Magi, are just packed with hidden symbolic meaning.
Is it true that you're setting your next book in Washington?
That is true. And that is all I'm allowed to say about it. I will say it is not a political thriller. It has the same themes of iconology, art, and secret history.
So do you think Washington is really going to be able to stand up alongside the Holy Roman Church as a setting for struggle and strife?
It's a terrific question. I was skeptical when I first started thinking of setting a book here that it could have the same sort of grandeur and punch as a place like Paris or Rome. In fact, the more I researched about Washington's architecture and its history, the more I'm starting to think, wow, it may surpass Rome in its secret history, and what a fascinating place.
We do run a minor specialty in cover-ups around here.
I have heard a little bit about that.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Brown's newest book is called The Da Vinci Code.